So let me remind you where we were from last time. So we were looking at, so if you have P in B of H, we were looking for conditions to make this operator similar to a contraction, right? And so we had a couple important notions. P was polynomially bounded. If you have the norm of P of T is less than a constant times the supernorm of P, which is sup over the unit disk. And of course, if it's a contraction, then you have constant 1 because of a Neumann inequality. And T is completely polynomially bounded. If you have the same thing for matrices, if this map P in the disk algebra goes to P of T is completely bounded, or equivalently, you have any matrix Pij of T is less than or equal to constant times the norm of the matrix Pij, where again, this is for all n by n matrices. And then we had, I guess we had one other notion, that T is power bounded. T is power bounded if the sup T to the n is finite and greater than or equal to 1. And then we had some partial results. Result of Foggy world exists T power bounded, but not completely polynomially bounded, not even polynomially bounded. Okay. And then we had a theorem by Paulson, which was T is similar to a contraction if and only if T is completely polynomially bounded. Okay. And so what I want to explain to you today is a rather non-trivial example of PZA. There exists a T which is polynomially bounded but not similar to a contraction. Because it's not completely polynomially bounded. All right. So now, last time I introduced a couple ideas, and one of the things that we were going to use are Hankel operators. So the scalar Hankel operators will have this form. They're constant on these backward diagonals. The typical entry is ij entry is ai plus j, depending only on that sum. Okay. And so if you have a, I are scalars, or you have ai belongs to b of h1, b of h2, and we can look at an operator of gamma that has a similar form, like this. Okay. And then we have the Nihari-Page theorem, which I talked about last time, that a Hankel operator gamma is bounded if and only if there exists a function f in L infinity of a circle with values in B of H1, B of H2, such that the negative Fourier coefficients give you those ans. And the norm of the Hankel operator is equal to the ints of f infinity, such that f hat of minus n is equal to an. And this is attained, and this, you can think of this is the distance from f to h infinity with of the circle with values in b of h1, b of h2. Okay.
The minimum cannot change to minimum.
Well, it is the minimum, because it's weak star closed, so it's the nth, but it's attained, yeah. That's elementary. Apparently that doesn't stay up. Right, anyway. Pardon me?
H infinity.
Yeah, so distance from the L infinity function to the H infinity functions. Right, because H infinity functions are the ones who negative Fourier coefficients are all zero, so obviously I can get one inequality is trivial, but in fact it's an equality. Okay. Now if you have if you take S to be the unilateral shift, okay, this is like multiplication by Z on H2, if we think it's H2, then you can see the following thing that happens. Suppose I have a Hankel operator. And I multiply it by S. So gamma S, well, this is the shift. And if you multiply, then you see that you pick up the second column, then the third column, et cetera, right? A2, A3, A3, A4, A4, A4. And the same thing is true if I multiply on the left side by the adjoint of S. Because that will read off the second row, the third row, the fourth row, et cetera. But if you start with the second row instead of the second column, you get the same effect. Okay. So, and this, if this was, and so in particular you have, if I take gamma of a function f times s, then this shifts the Fourier series 1 to the right. So this is gamma of zf is f star gamma. Okay. And if I have operators instead of scalars, then the same thing works if I have shifts with the right multiplicities. Okay? So the operator case, you take gamma F times S tensor identity on H1 is equal to gamma of ZF is equal to S star tensor identity on H2, gamma F So let me, for convenience, call this S2 star and this S1. Okay. So I'm going to look for a certain kind of operators which Vern and I called Fogwell-Hankel operators. So remember the Fogwell example. So this was his example back here, was an operator of this form, had S star there, 0 here, S here, and had a certain operator up in the right-hand corner, and we took that to be a projection onto a lacunary sequence of the basis elements and proved that it was polynomially bounded but not, sorry, power bounded but not polynomially bounded. Okay, so we're going to take something of that form. I'm going to take T to be S2 star gamma F 0 S1. And we call these Fogwell-Hankel operators because they're Fogwell-type operators with a Hankel operator in the upper right-hand corner. But there was another reason. There was back in the 70s, Foyash and Williams wrote a draft of a paper about these kind of operators and proved some of their elementary properties, and were looking for a counterexample, I think, to this question. This paper was never published. Jim Williams got very ill, eventually died in early 80s from cancer. But the Russian school studied these things. In particular, Vladimir Peller looked at these operators and wrote a number of papers on them. We'll see some of his results in a minute. And in an early version of my paper with Vern, where we gave an easier proof of PGH counterexample, we called them Foyash-Williams operators. Now, this got Peller very angry, but we didn't want to change them to Peller operators either, so we called them Fogwell-Hankel operators. That's recent. Okay, so if I take T to the N, then if you multiply that out, well, you get S2 star to the N, 0, S1 to the N. That's the easy part. And then what you get here is sum from I equals 0 to N minus 1 of S2 star to the I, gamma F S1 to the N minus 1 minus I. Okay, but because of this identity here, I can pull all these S2 stars through to the other side. So you get S2 star to the N and S1 to the N, and here I get N things all the same, gamma F S1 to the N minus 1, and I can also bring it inside the function, and it's S2 star to the N gamma of F times NZ to the N minus 1, 0 S1 to the N. Well, NZ to the N minus 1 is a derivative of Z to the N. Okay, so therefore, if P is a polynomial, P of T is equal to P of S2 star, P of S1 here, and here I have gamma F times P primed of S1, which is, I can also put that in the function, FP primed of Z, okay, and P of Z there. Okay, so. You can see then that sort of T is polynomially bounded if and only if there exists a constant so that gamma of FP prime of Z is less than or equal to a constant times P infinity. All right. And it's completely polynomially bounded if and only if this map P goes to gamma of FP prime of Z is completely bounded. Because the diagonal maps are completely isometric. Okay. So all the bad norm, if it happens, is in the upper right-hand corner. And because we've put a Hankel operator there, we've got an example where we can do calculations. We have a nice formula, but it has this derivative in it, and the derivative gives you potential for something to go wrong. All right. All right. So, the Alexandrov-Peller theorem. So, Peller was essentially studying the scalar case. Okay? Right? Scalar-valued functions. And he was coming up with various conditions that would make this operator polynomially bounded, power bounded, finding a difference between power bounded and polynomially bounded in this class. And eventually Alexandrov and Peller characterized in a scalar case when you got polynomially bounded or when you got similar to a contraction. Okay, so they solved the problem for this class of operators, and they found that there's a positive answer. Okay, so anyway, we have some spaces around. H2 is just the set of all set of all F in L2, such that F hat of N is equal to 0 for N less than 0. So this is the set of all F of Z is the summation of ANZ to the N. N equals 0 to infinity. So the L2 norm of that sequence is finite. Okay. So I can start talking about the space of derivatives of H2 functions, okay? H2 prime, these are the set of derivatives of H2 functions. So these are going to be the set of all G, which will be the derivatives of that. So it's going to be N A N Z to the N minus 1 from N equals 1 to infinity. Okay. Again, such that AN squared is finite. But of course, we don't want to write it that way. We want to write it in terms of the coefficients of G. So this is instead of all G of Z, sum from N equals 0 to infinity, let's say BNZ to the N, such that you have the sum from N equals 1, N equals 0 to infinity of BN squared over N plus 1 squared is finite, right? I think I got that right. Yeah. Okay. All Well, one of the things we want to know is that multiplying by h infinity functions actually maps derivatives of h2 functions to derivatives of h2 functions. So there's another space of functions. I'm going to call it S2. So this is the set of all f of z equals sum of a n z to the n on the unit disk, such that the S2 square norm, this is the integral over the unit disk of f of z squared times 1 minus absolute value z with respect to area. Okay, so it's easy to work out what that means. Okay, so in other words, this becomes an integral from 0 to 1 of 1 over 2 pi, integral from 0 to 2 pi of f of r e to the I theta squared d theta times 1 minus r times r dr. Right? Because area measure is 1 over 2 pi. No, it's 1 over pi, isn't it? All right. Well, 2. Okay. But we know how to compute that because this is just the L2 norm on the circle of the function whose Fourier series is anr to the n. So this integral is just the summation of an squared r to the 2n from n equals 0 to infinity. And so then when you do this integral, you get summation of an squared from n equals 0 to infinity times a certain, let's do it over here. So I'm looking at r to the 2n plus 1 minus r to the 2n plus 2, and there's a 2 in front from 0 to 1 dr is something like 2 times 1 over 2n plus 2 minus 1 over 2n plus 3. Is that right? Yeah. So this is 2 over 2n plus 1 times 2n plus 2 times 2n plus 3, and this cancels into there. 1 over n plus 1 times 2n plus 3. All right. So I can put that over here. All right. So that's a little bit of calculus there, so we have to prove that we can prove things here. Anyway, compare the two. They're pretty much the same. Here I have bn squared over n plus 1 times n plus 1. Here I have bn squared, anyway, over n plus 1 times n plus 3. Well, n plus 3, 2n plus 3 is bigger than 2n plus 1 is less than 3n, 2n plus 2 and is bigger than 3n plus 3. So, we get some inequality that puts us, I wonder which one I want on which side here. Yeah. GS2 then is less than 1/2 G in H2 prime and bigger than 1/3 G in H2 prime. The point is that they're comparable Hilbert space norms. Okay. So again, as a consequence, corollary, if h belongs to h infinity and g belongs to h2 prime, then hg belongs to h2 prime. Yes?
What is the normal h squared dash?
H2 prime is this, right, so I'm going to call that G, the norm in H2 prime, yes. Okay. Right, well, why? Because if I look at HG in the S2 norm, right, this is the integral of H of Z squared times G of Z squared 1 minus absolute Z dA of Z to the 1/2. And you can pull out an H infinity out of just pulling that out, and then you get GS2. So multiplication is contractive in this ST norm, so its norm is no bigger than, I guess, 3/2 when I multiply in H2 prime. Okay. All right. So the theorem is Alexandrov-Peller is something slightly different. It says if G belongs to H2 prime, then there exist H1 and H2 and H infinity, F1 and F2 and H2 such that G is equal to H1 prime F1 plus H2 prime F2. Notice the derivative is on the H infinity function, not on the H2 function. And the sum, the obvious estimate here, H infinity norm of HI times the 2 norm here, I equals 1 to 2, this is less than a constant times the norm of G. When I did my notes, I got a 66 for the constant, but I kept having to increase it up because I realized I forgot this or that. Safer just to put C. And in fact, once you know that everyone has this property, then you can use the open mapping theorem to get the constant without knowing it. All right? I mean, it's just a consequence of the open mapping theorem that there is a constant. But it's constructive, so you can actually check this. And for those of you who like tensor products, I mean, there's we can think of this as this map from H infinity prime projective tensor product with H2 into H2 prime is surjective. Okay. But what's that? Oh, the set of derivatives of H infinity functions whose norm is given by the soup norm of the H infinity function it's the derivative of, with say 0, 0, something like that. Yeah, so I'm not going to use this formulation at all, so I'm just putting it in that for people who like tensor products, which I'm not actually one. Yeah, because mine is stronger because it has just, that's right. And I'm going to use the stronger version, okay? So, as far as I can see, the tensor product doesn't even prove you that there's ever a finite sum that does it. So, anyway. Okay. Well, why is this even we don't even know, well, why this is even an H2 prime function. All right, so if H is an H infinity and F is an H2, this implies that HF is an H2. So you have HF prime. Okay, well, this clearly belongs to H2 prime. But this is equal to H prime F plus HF prime by the chain rule. And I just showed you over here this corollary that since F prime is an H2 prime, this belongs to H2 prime. And therefore H prime F belongs to H2 prime. Okay, so what do I do? It's a little tricky here. Yes. Okay. So let's take this G. And we can write G equals F prime, where F is in H20. In other words, to save all, so this is save all F in H2, such that F of 0 is 0. Or F hat of 0, if you like. I guess we're speaking Fourier series. All right, the 0 coefficient is 0. You don't need that because the derivative of a constant is 0. Okay. And I claim that F can be written as F1 minus F2, where the Fi's belong to H2, the real part of Fi's are 0, and Fi's aren't too big. Now, let U be the real part of F. And I can write this as U1 minus U2, where U1 is positive and U2 is positive. And the two norms of the U's are controlled, okay? That's going to be 0 at 0. All right, if I just took U and split it into its positive part and its negative part, then that would do it. But I want them to be strictly positive, so I have to add a little bit. Okay, so say U1 is equal to C0 plus the sum n greater than or equal to 1 of Cn z to the n plus right, it's going to have a Fourier series like that because it's self-adjoint, it's positive, and U2 will be have the same constant here, dnz to the n plus dn bar z bar to the n. And then these are the real parts of these analytic functions. So let F1 be C0 plus, I guess, really, for convenience, put a little a half here. So then I can just write here, C0 Cn z to the n, n equals 1 to infinity. And here's dn z n. Okay. So the real part of Fi is equal to ui is positive. And the real part of F1 minus F2 is equal to U1 minus U2 is equal to U is equal to the real part of F. Okay. But this belongs to H2, and F belongs to H2. So if you have two H2 functions, if you have two H2 functions which have the same real part, they differ by an imaginary constant. But if they're both zero, it's zero. An imaginary constant zero. So F is equal to F1 minus F2. So that does what I wanted. You just sort of check. The norm of F is, what is the norm of Fi squared is less than or equal to, well, I guess the norm of Fi is less than or equal to 2, the norm of Ui, and there, that does what I want. Okay. And that's clearly less than or equal to 2 norm of U, which is less than or equal to 2 norm of F. Okay. So that does that. Okay. So here's the clever thing, that hi of z equal e to the I logarithm of fi of z. See, because we have positive real part, the values of fi of z belong to the right half plane. So there's a natural branch of the logarithm that's to take. So this is log of fi of z is analytic, and the imaginary part of log fi of z can be chosen is in I choose a branch, so I get between plus or minus pi over 2. Okay. Right, because I'm just taking the logarithm in the right half plane. Okay, so that's a nice analytic function. Okay, and hi infinity is equal to e to the real part of this. Okay, but the real part of I times something is minus the imaginary part, right? So it's minus the imaginary part of log fi of z. So that's less than or equal to e to the pi over 2. It's finite. So hi belongs to h infinity. Okay. And then what do you have to multiply it by to get fi? Well, you let ki equal fi divided by hi. Well, if you look at hi inverse, that's also less than e to the pi over 2. Okay. Same argument. Okay. So this belongs to H2. Okay. And let's just calculate hi prime ki. Well, h is an exponential. So its derivative is the exponential itself, again, hi, times the derivative of the numerator, which is I, times fi primed over fi. Now we multiply that by k, which is fi over hi, and we get a lot of cancellation. So let me fix up that I. Let's put a minus I here. Where this I, of course, is the imaginary I. It's not this index. It's sorry about that. It's too late now. So there it is. So amazingly slick. I have no idea how they came up with this. But some point down the line, somebody observed this clever thing, and then when I look at the sum of hi infinity times fi in the 2 norm, this is less than or equal to what, e to the pi over 2. There's two such terms, and these fi's are no bigger than f times 2, so this is a constant times the norm of F2, which is a constant times the norm of G in H2 prime. Maybe a different constant, because maybe, no, it's the same, because obviously I make the L2 norm of G, that's equal. Smallest when I choose the H2 zero function. Okay, so that proves that theorem here of Alexandrov and Peller. Okay, so let's get back to operator theory. So we have the following theorem, and this is due to Alexandrov and Peller in the scalar case, and it's due to me and Vern Paulsen in the vector case. And the scalar case is a somewhat different formulation, but I'm going to formulate it in a way that's valid in the vector case. And it's the vector case that's going to lead us to these counterexamples, but nevertheless. So I'm going to take f in L infinity of the circle with values in H2. So when I say H2, I'm thinking of this as the bounded operators from C into H2. In other words, it's column space. Column Hilbert space, okay? All right, and I got my function, let's call it RF here, which is going to be S2, this Fogel-Hankel operator with gamma F in that corner. So this S1 is just the usual unilateral shift, but S2 star is the shift of infinite multiplicity, okay? Following our equivalent. One is that RF is similar to a contraction. Two. RF is polynomially bounded. No counterexamples here. And three, gamma F times D is bounded, where DF is the derivative, say, on the polynomials contained in H2. Okay. So, this gives an answer, but it shows there are no counterexamples here. Okay. And, in fact, in the scalar case, Alexandrov and Peller, instead of this condition, what they have is gamma of F prime. But there's a chain rule thing. Gamma F prime is, well, sort of gamma FD plus D gamma F There's some shifts in there. Got to be a little careful. But that's not equivalent in the vector case. This is the right version for the vector case. Yes. No, no. The ones, I don't think so. I don't think there's any natural decomposition on the circle that you can see. Yeah, well, but it's an H3 and H2. They have radial limits almost everywhere anyway. But I don't know. All right, well, let me just try this proof. All right, so 1 implies 2 is trivial. Okay, so we're interested in 2 implies 3. Well, remember that P of RF is equal to P of S2 star 0, P of S1 here, and here we have gamma of F times P primed of S1. Okay. And RF polynomially bounded means that the norm of gamma F times P primed of S1 is less or equal to constant times P infinity. Okay. You can easily extend this to H infinity functions from polynomials by taking weak star, bounded weak star limits. Okay. And I'm going to do that because I want to use this theorem. All right. Now, we can write P prime equal H1 prime F1 plus H2 primed F2, where the HIs are in H infinity, the FIs are in H2, and the sum of the infinity norm of the HIs times the two norms of the F is less than or equal to another constant, let me call it M, times P2. Right. P2. Okay. Okay. P2, I think I want, right? Yes. All right. So let's try to compute the norm of gamma F D acting on P. Okay, P belongs, so P is a polynomial in H2. I'm trying to show that gamma F D is bounded, okay? So this is gamma F P prime. Let's drop the norms here. Gamma F DP is gamma F P prime, gamma F H1 prime F1 plus gamma F H2 prime F2, which is equal to gamma F H1 primed of S1 F1. See, that's because, after all, if you take H of S1, S1 is multiplication by Z on H2, and H of S1 is multiplication by H. So H prime of S1 is multiplication by H prime. I mean, the fact that this is bounded is only in conjunction with being multiplied on the left by gamma F, right? All right, so therefore, gamma F dP is less than or equal to gamma F H1 primed of S1 times F1 plus gamma F H2 primed of S1 F2. And so now this is less than C times H1 infinity times F1 2 plus H2 infinity F2 2, which is less than or equal to Cm times 2 norm of P, which is equal to Cm times the, I guess that's what I wanted. Yeah. So, gamma Fd is finite. Okay, so that is a simple proof. Okay. And finally, 3 implies 1 has a simple proof. And this is what allowed us to eliminate the really hard part of PCA's analysis, was this matrix calculation. Okay, this was the hard direction. You write it down. So that gamma D is bounded, then you do the following calculation. F gamma FD is finite, so we can write that. And here I have my operator. And here I take the inverse of that, which has a plus gamma FD. And let's multiply that out. Well, nothing's happening here to these two diagonal entries, and everything's up a triangular. Everything's happening up in this entry. So what's happening here is that when I multiply the first two, I get gamma F minus gamma F D S1, and then when I multiply it by this one, I pick that up again and I add S2 star gamma F times D. Okay, so let's just concentrate on what this entry is here. This is gamma F times identity minus DS1. Now the S2 star can come through and become an S1 on the other side. Okay. But if you now check this on the basis element to see what happens, all right, let's take I minus DS1 plus S1D acting on Z to the N, you get Z to the N minus Z, the derivative of Z to the N plus 1 plus derivative of Z to the N, which is N Z to the N minus 1 multiplied by Z, is N Z to the N is equal to 0. In other words, this is one of those ways of writing the identity as a commutator when one of the things is unbounded. Okay. But this makes sense on the polynomials, and that we know that when you multiply through by gamma f, it becomes a bounded operator. So this makes sense as a bounded operator, which on the polynomials is zero. So it's the zero operator. And that's a contraction, because you get two isometries on the two isometry and a co-isometry on the diagonal. Okay. All right. So we'll take a short break, and then afterwards I'll show you how we turn that into PGA's counterexample.
How bright is it now?
All right. Suppose phi is a map from B of H1, H2 over to B of H3, H4, bounded map. Okay. Then we can define phi twiddle from the Hankel operators with values in B of H1, H2 to the Hankel operators B of H3, H4 by phi twiddle of the operator with entries A1, A2, A2, Aij, Ai plus j here equals the Hankel matrix whose entries are phi of A1, phi of A2, phi of A2, phi of Ai plus j. Okay. And the norm of phi twiddle is equal to the norm of phi. And the proof of this is straightforward, right? So by the Nahari page, we have our matrix Ai plus j is gamma f for some f in L infinity with values in B of H1, H2 with infinity norm of f equal to the norm of this operator. Okay, so this Hankel operator is Hankel operator of a H infinity function whose values are, all right, which is bounded by the same norm. And this will have a Fourier series, an z to the minus n from minus infinity to infinity. I'm putting the minus n in there just because I'm thinking of these a1, a2, a3, etc. as being the negative Fourier coefficients of my function. And we have some convergence issues. So for a technical reason, I just, for 0 less than or equal to r less than 1, I can let fr be equal to the sum from minus infinity to infinity of an r to the absolute n e to the minus I n theta. Okay. Well, let me just make that, let me make that z to the n. Sorry. So this is just looking at the values by sort of exploding out the disk of radius r out to the disk on the boundary. Now this is absolutely convergent. Okay, and now I don't have so many problems when I look at this. So if I look at phi twiddle of this operator A1R, A2R squared, A2R squared, Ai plus j, r to the I plus j along here. If I look at that, that's phi twiddle of gamma of fr. Okay. And this is the corresponding Hinkle operator, phi1 of AR, phi of A2 R squared, phi of A I plus J, R to the I plus J. Okay. Well, that is a Hinkle operator, and it's the Hinkle operator of the function phi of F. That doesn't make sense. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah, phi of FR, where this is defined to be equal to just this summation of phi of AN R at the absolute N, Z to the minus N, which converges absolutely. Right, this is absolutely convergent. So this is phi of the summation of AN R to the N Z to the minus N. So that's phi of FR of Z. Okay, so in other words, this makes sense point-wise. This makes sense as a function, so that we get that this norm of phi twiddle of gamma FR is then less than or equal to the phi of FR of Z infinity norm, which is less than or equal to norm of phi times the norm of FR. Sorry, all right. Which is less than or equal to norm of phi times norm of f, infinity, right? Because everything was point-wise, and there's no convergence problems, but now this converges in the strong operator topology to phi twiddle of gamma f, and therefore we get the same inequality there. All right, so the whole reason of passing to the R's is just so that you get absolute convergence, so that you can evaluate this function term by term and have it all add up. Okay. So, oh, I've lost my lemma. I wasn't supposed to use that board. Ha! All right. Well, there's the lemma. Okay, it hasn't gone away. So, I have these operators over here, and what this lemma is saying is that if I apply some linear map here, I can replace this function f, which is a vector, with something else. And the idea is to use a linear map which is bounded but not completely bounded, and therefore get something which is polynomially bounded, but the complete polynomial boundedness will go away. All right, so we need the following position. Here's the function lambda from Hilbert space into bounded operators on Hilbert space, which is bounded. But not completely bounded. So the idea is to use the Carré algebra okay. And the Carré algebra stands for canonical anti-commutation relations, comes from representing certain relations from mathematical physics, but this is just an AF C star algebra, or UHF C star algebra in fact. The direct limit here, where the typical embedding is from A goes to A direct sum A at every stage. So it's a unital embedding. It's the unique unital embedding of M2 to the N into M2 to the N plus 1 up to unitary equivalence. And there's a unique C star algebra. Okay. And I can tell you operators that are in the limit there by giving you a bunch of operators in the N operators in the M2 to the N, and then I'll just go up there. So here's the idea. Let C be the matrix 0, 0, 1, 0, and V be this symmetry 0, 0, 0, minus 1. Okay. And for 0, less than or equal to I, less than or equal to N minus 1, if N is an integer, I can set VI equals V, tensored with itself I times, so V tensor V tensor V, tensor C, tensor identity, 2 by 2 identity, how many times N minus I minus 1 times that are left. So these are matrices that sit inside M2 to the N. And this will go, then, I'm going to call it lambda of EI in the C star algebra A when I take the inductive limit. Okay. And so you can calculate, you have the following identities. CI CJ plus CJ CI is equal to 0 for all I and J. CI CJ star plus CJ, oops, sorry, plus CJ star CI is equal to 0 if I is not equal to J, and the identity if I is equal to J.
The matrix C, you mean it's
0, 1, 0, 1, 1
over.
Yeah.
You want Hermitian or the C Hermitian?
No, it's not Hermitian.
You want to
multiply. Yep. Well, I'm not going to multiply them. This is a linear space thing. Okay, but they do. I guess I multiplied them here. I mean, if you just multiply it out, you can get those identities. And so then, if you look at lambda of a sequence AI in little l2, the summation of AI CI. Okay, that's what this map looks like. And we want to understand what that is. We want to compute the norm of lambda of AI squared. So this is the sum of AI CI. And I can assume that I'm talking about a finite sum here, so I'm working in 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrices, okay? So let's say I'm going 0 to n minus 1 here. All right, so the norm squared, well, that's the sum over I and J of AI, AJ bar, CJ star, CI, because I can multiply, if you just take, if this is X, then this is X star X. But it's also equal to XX star, which is the summation of AI, AJ bar, CI, CJ star. Okay. They're the same norm. They're both positive. So this norm is comparable. In fact, actually equal, in fact, but I'm not going to bother to just do the simple calculation to see why it's equal, but it's in fact equal to the sum of AI AJ bar CJ star CI plus CI CJ star. Right? Well, clearly the sum is bigger. On the other hand, the sum has norm no more than twice this, so they're comparable. But in fact, that's an equality because basically because this is a C is a partial isometry, and C star have orthogonal ranges. Okay, so that's what's going on. Anyway, these are mostly zero, except for the AI. So this is the norm of the summation of AI squared times the identity, which is the summation of AI squared. So this is, in fact, an isometric embedding of Hilbert space into B of H. Okay. On the other hand, I claim that if I look at a sum of AI CI tensor CI, that is comparable to the L1 norm. Okay, well, obviously, this is bounded above by the L1 norm. That's a trivial estimate. All right. Okay, so we want to know why it's greater. And to get this inequality, let's write AK as omega K times absolute AK, where omega K is modulus 1. All right. And let's XK be the vector 1 over root 2 E1 tensor E1 plus omega k over root 2 E2 tensor E2. This belongs to C2 tensor C2. Okay. And then you can just check, if you look at what V tensor V does to XK. Well, V is this little matrix 1, 0, 0, minus 1. So V leaves E1 alone. So V tensor V leaves E1 tensor E1 alone. And it sends E2 to minus E2, but twice. So it sends E2 tensor E2 to E2 tensor E2. So V tensor V of XK is equal to XK. Okay. And if you look at C tensor C, XK, inner product XK, if we look at this, that what we're getting is that we're, let's see. So C tensor C, C sends E1 to E2. And sends E2 to 0. Okay. And here I have XK. And so you end up with omega K bar over 2. Okay. What's what that? All right. Okay. Yeah. All righty. So if I let X equal, let me see, X0, what do I do? Tensor X1 tensor Xn minus 1 in C to the 4n here. Okay. then the norm of AK, CK, sensor CK, oops, I'm sorry, I'm using I's, my equals 0 to n minus 1 is bigger than or equal to the inner product of that sum, AI, CI, tensor CI, acting on X, inner product X. So I have the sum over I's of this AI's, and then what's happening here when I look at CI tensor CI, remember CI had a bunch of V's at the beginning and a bunch of I's at the end, but the V tensor V's just leave the XK's alone, and the I tensor I's leave the XK's alone, and the C tensor C XK XK pulls out an omega bar. I don't know how I went from I, I guess, anyway. So here I have an omega I over 2, which is 1 half sum of AI. So, what this really means is that this is not a completely bounded map. If I take X to be this sum from K equals 0, n minus 1 of, I don't know why I'm changing to k, I equals 0 to n minus 1 of AI, EI, tensor CI, then you can check the norm of X squared is the norm of X star X, is the norm of the sum over I and J of AI, AJ bar, you have EJ star EI times CJ star CI. This is equal to delta IJ. So this is the sum of AI absolute value squared times CI star CI, which is a projection. Okay, so this is less than or equal to the sum of AI squared. Okay, so that's... So when I apply lambda to this thing, I'm going to get something that blows up like the L1 norm. So lambda tensor identity of X is the sum from I equals 0 to n minus 1 of AI CI tensor CI. And so the norm of that is on the order of the summation of AI. So that's not bounded. I mean, that's, so the bigger I make n, the bigger I can make this relationship, okay? Okay. So, that tells us where we should go with the PVA example.
You want the match from P of H to P of H, rather from H to P of H.
Well, I'm... For that lemma? Well, I mean, I'm thinking... Well, it is H to B of H. But I'm thinking of H as being operators from the scalars into H, the column Hilbert space. Okay. So, so take our operator over there, and let's apply lambda to it. I guess I need a special case. I didn't go back. I didn't do that. Back up. Yeah, all right. Let's go back to that theorem over there. and consider as F in L infinity of a circle with values in H of a special type. Okay, so I'm going to take F to be a sum of A n e n z to the minus n, n equals 1 to infinity, where the AI belongs to L2. So gamma F looks like A1, E1, A2, E2, A2, E2, AI plus J, EI plus J. So this is a Hankel operator where these columns are vectors with vector entries, and these columns are orthogonal to each other. Okay, because E1 is orthogonal to E2, is orthogonal to E3, etc. So on each level, they're orthogonal, in fact. Okay. So in fact, this operator is bounded by the L2 norm because the L2 norm of each column is at most the L2 norm of this sequence, and they're pairwise orthogonal. Okay. All right. Well, we have a corollary to our theorem over there, is that, let me call this F, or F alpha, where alpha is that guy. Okay. Then R of F alpha is similar to a contraction. If and only if A, which is the soup over K greater or equal to K greater or equal to 0 of K plus 1 summation of AI squared from I equals K to infinity to the 1/2 is finite. Okay, well, this gamma F alpha, if I look at gamma F alpha, then the fact that those columns are pairwise orthogonal, like when you take X star X, the ij entry is the inner product of the ith column with the jth column. So you're going to get a diagonal operator. So this is a diagonal operator, and the entry for the ith column is the sum from K equals I to infinity of AI squared. Okay. And so this is from I equals 1 to infinity. So if I give that a name, beta sub I, then this is just the operator beta 1, beta 2, beta 3. Okay. Now the theorem says that RF alpha is similar to a contraction if and only if
gamma F alpha D is bounded.
Okay. But if I look at gamma F alpha D times its adjoint, all right, then that's D star times this diagonal, that beta I times D. What does D look like? Well, D is a backward shift. It takes the constants to zero. It takes Z to one times the constant. It takes Z squared to two times Z squared, etc. So this is a backward shift, backward-weighted shift that multiplies by n at the nth spot. So you can check then that this is, and then it shifts it back the other way. So this shifts back. So if I start at z to the n, multiplies by n, shifts back, picks up an n minus 1. So this is I beta I minus 1, diagonal I beta squared, does it twice, I squared beta I minus 1 from I equals 1 to infinity. Okay. So the norm of this is just the soup then of I squared beta I minus 1, or I plus 1 squared beta I, which is what I wrote over there, I guess. Right? So this is finite if and only if this is finite, and this is the square of that. Okay. So I have a family then of operators that I'm going to apply this lambda to. I didn't write this down very carefully. I should have. Oh, here we go. If A, that quantity, which is the soup, k plus 1, k greater than 0, k plus 1 summation of AI squared I equals k to infinity to the 1/2 is finite, but B, which is the sum k equals 0 to infinity of k plus 1 squared ak squared is equal to plus infinity, then this operator R of lambda of F alpha, okay, which is S2 star 0 S1 star gamma lambda of F alpha, is polynomially bounded, but not completely polynomially bounded. So not similar to a contraction. Okay, so we've got all the machinery that we needed, okay? So by this corollary, we get that if this A is finite, then we get a polynomially bounded operator, RF alpha, okay? And then, I erased it. It was right here, right? We've got this bounded map from the one set of bounded operators, bounded up like H2 thought it was column space, into B, which this map lambda is bounded but not completely bounded. We apply that to the F alphas, and then by that lemma, the norm of the Hankel the norm on the Hankel operators is so we get that we still get a bounded operator here. Okay. So the corollary says that this RF alpha is similar to, is completely polynomially bounded, okay, in fact. And then we have this map H, which we think of as bounded C into H over into B of H, is isometric. So by our lemma, this lambda twiddle mapping operators from B of H to Hankel operators B of H is bounded. In fact, norm one. Okay. So if I'm taking a polynomial R of lambda of F alpha, so this P of S2 star and P of S1, and here I have gamma of lambda of P prime of Z, then you get the norm of then the diagonal part plus the norm of that corner but this is infinity plus the norm of F alpha prime, and that's a constant times P infinity because RF alpha is polynomially bounded. Okay. Polynomially boundedness of alpha gives you polynomial boundedness of this lambda then. But it doesn't give you complete polynomial boundedness. And that's check. That's the last thing to check. So, if this R lambda F alpha is completely bounded, then this map C of P goes to the gamma of lambda of F alpha P prime of Z. That is a completely bounded map. And then I just take this entry to be a completely, right? Completely bounded. All right.